Neil, we're glad you could be here, and we'd like to hear your thoughts on air traffic control.
It's a real pleasure to be here, and I'm very happy that you invited me and that Dr. Goldmunt couldn't come. It's true, in the agency, when we fly the aircraft, they send two pilots. We meet all the airline requirements, and then we have a few additional ones of our own. It got to be kind of a joke. Whenever the other pilot said, "Wouldn't you like to fly the next leg?" I didn't have to talk to the weatherman. I knew it was right down on the deck. Now, the ATC Advisory Committee was formed by the Department of Transportation in the summer of 1968, and they submitted their report to the Secretary in August of this year. The report represented a study of the ATC traffic forecast for the period from now through 1995, a review of the agency's automation program. It contains a design approach for the improvement of the automation system so that the traffic forecast for 1995 can be handled. And in addition, it defines the research and development program which is necessary to support the development of the new system. Now, the committee, whose names are on the view graph, was a very active committee in that the members of the committee participated in the many study efforts that were conducted under their direction. Ben Alexander is the chairman of the group, and he's also the chairman of the board and technical director of the General Research Corporation. Dr. Tom Amley is the technical director of the Naval Weapons Center in China Lake. Jim Densmore is the deputy assistant secretary for research and technology of the department. Bob Everett is the president of MITRE. Dr. Glazer is the director of the Jennings Computer Center and a very forward-looking person in the computer area. Dr. Goldman works in the office of the Assistant Secretary for Research and Technology and was the extremely hard-working executive secretary for our group. Dick Huff, who you may remember generated the Beacon Report several years back, is vice president of the American Telephone and Telegraph Company. Dr. John Meyer, an economist and president of the National Bureau of Economic Research. Dr. Perkins, who is the chairman of the Department of Aerospace and Mechanical Sciences at Princeton. Dr. Rowena, Vice President for Special Laboratories, MIT. And General J. Francis Taylor, retired, President of Aeronautical Radio, Incorporated. Now, the committee conducted a detailed analysis of the present ATC system and identified the problems existing in that system, examined the forecast demand for services by the users through 1995. In examining that forecast, they expect the traffic to double about every 10 years. But the demand for services in the next 10 years is expected to increase by an order of magnitude, which puts a severe load on our present system. They evaluated alternative approaches for improving the system and conducted the study effort necessary to define the requirements and the design approach to be taken in upgrading our present system. The areas where the committee concentrated their effort were three: increasing terminal capacity, increasing air safety, and increasing the capacity of the airspace system in the high-density areas while limiting the rapidly rising cost of staffing the present system. The present FAA program for the automation of the en route and terminal areas, called respectively the NAS program and the ARTS program, is based on meeting the traffic demands from now through 1979. If no further automation is undertaken than that which is in our present program, the cost of operating the system for control personnel alone, the increased cost will be $1 billion by 1980, roughly double the current expenditure. Now, in addition, the study pointed out that the system will be saturated by 1980 in the major terminal areas with this level of automation, and it will be necessary to constrain traffic flow in these areas if no further automation is undertaken. So the two factors, saturation of the system and the tremendously fast rise in the cost of operating the system, led the committee to the conclusion that automation was not a luxury, but was absolutely required for the future success of our system. The committee, in order to carry out their work, established the staff. Those are the people that do the work. And the staff consisted of about 25 people from the agency, the Department of Defense, and NASA. And they were supported by approximately 150 people whose time was donated by industry. Two people from Collins were most helpful to us in this study, John Holt and Gene Martin. Now, Group 1 was charged with studying the capacity which presently exists at our major airport. And they examined what improvements could be made through the use of improved runway and taxiway design, improved airport surface design, by instituting new procedures, and by adding full automation to the terminal area. And we'll look briefly at the recommendations of this group in a minute. The second group was the automation group. We called it Decreasing Reliance on Human Factors. That's a good political title. We had really three major efforts under it. One was to determine where the present system saturated, and we call this an airspace group. We had a data acquisition group whose whole purpose in life was to examine the various approaches possible to us for improving the accuracy and the reliability of the data which we feed into our automation system. And a computer sizing group that had an enormous task to do, as they had to define the algorithms or the approach to performing each of the automation functions which the committee recommended for inclusion in the future system. Having defined them, they had to simulate them and to estimate the size of the program in instructions per second. Compare this summation with the technology which was forecast for the time period and to conclude whether it was or was not feasible to do it. The third group was concerned with safety of the airspace. And they conducted a detailed analysis of the mid-air collisions and collision situations. They generated a model which allows one to forecast the most probable collision rate over the next few years. And they concluded that a new service must be provided by the ATC system, namely the provision of a digital data link to all aircraft operating in controlled airspace through which one would provide collision avoidance vectors. And we'll look at this in some detail in a minute. The fourth group was concerned with upgrading our forecast of the future traffic demand on the system. While most of the groups turned out reports which would fill about 2 feet of the bookshelf, this one, thank heavens, only filled several inches. The report at the present time has reached a volume of some 300 pages, and the supporting studies and appendices exceed 3,000. And this represents only a small part of the work that was actually done. The fifth group was the system engineering group, and they considered four different system approaches in some depth. And there was a working group for each of these systems. The first one considers delegated as much responsibility to the aircraft cockpit and to the pilot as was possible. Now, the group that worked in this area finally concluded, however, that the sequencing of traffic, the advanced flow planning of traffic, must be done on the ground. They concluded that the navigation must remain in the cockpit, and they recommended that some of the separation assurance be done in the cockpit. The other three systems were what we call central management type. They all relied heavily on a ground-located air traffic control system. And they differed, the three approaches differed mostly in the type of data acquisition system used to provide the data to the computers on the ground. The first one looked at was a satellite system. And while the satellite offers better coverage to lower altitudes and the possibility of measuring altitude to 100 feet directly, we could not find during the course of the study any technology which would allow us to control 50,000 aircraft simultaneously, which is the number of aircraft demanding service in 1995. The committee concluded, however, that studies should be continued in this area to develop the necessary technology for implementation around the turn of the century. The other two ground systems differed only in the data acquisition area. One was based on determining aircraft position through trilateration computation and was based on the use of time frequency technology. The other system modified the present ATC radar beacon system to become a discrete address roll call data link system operating on the beacon frequency. After considerable study, the distinctions between the system turned out to be rather negligible. Some functions were assigned to the cockpit, the navigation and landing guidance. Some were assigned to the ground, that is, the control, the advanced planning, the sequencing. So the differences finally resolved down to whether the separation or station-keeping function should be done on the ground or done in the air. Now, the equipment and procedures required for both approaches were examined, and the committee concluded that since air traffic control was really the control of many aircraft by a single facility, and that the separation function was better performed on the ground, it resulted in less equipment being required in the aircraft. And this was the approach that they selected. Now getting back to the work of three of the groups, the first group again was working on increasing the capacity of our present airport system. They considered three different runway configurations. The conventional runway with a 40-mile-an-hour turnoff shown at the top, an improved runway shown in the middle. The left end, you have a sort of a launching ramp for departures. They can be in position ready to go on the diagonal. As soon as the aircraft has landed and turned off from the runway, then the departure can be released and some improvement in rate is possible. And the bottom one, which was finally recommended for implementation, is the dual-lane runway. It consists of two runways 700 feet apart. The bottom runway is the departure runway, and the upper runway is the arrival runway. The method of operation is that departure is in position, and as soon as the arrival is committed and has landed, then the departure is released. There is that degree of dependence. Now, this chart shows the impact of really three different things which can be done to increase capacity. The first, we've examined the impact of various runway configurations. And if you'll follow across the top line, we took data from our present operation and we tabulated it both for arrivals and mixed arrival and departure situations as a function of the three runway types which we saw on the previous slide. We then computed what these numbers should be based on our separation standards. And you can see that the controllers were cheating a little in the first case. Then we said, we can achieve, by doing this, a 40% increase in traffic handling capacity by doing nothing other than changing the pavement. We then said, what is the impact of adding automation? The first one examined was the case where the computer aided the manual system and told the controller what headings, when to reduce speed, when to change altitude, but the controller transmitted the message directly to the pilot over the voiced link. There was some improvement. We felt we could achieve an accuracy or a standard deviation of 11 seconds, plus or minus, in delivering aircraft to the runway. We next added a digital data link, which was capable of feeding the same information directly to the pilot or to the autopilot, and we felt we could achieve a much improved standard deviation of 5 seconds. Well, the impact of this type of automation is to give one a 35% approximately increase over what one could do with pavement alone. We then conducted a risk study. This was based on having a certain level of automation. It was based on having computer surveillance of the final approach areas, and the figures came out that it is in fact safe to reduce spacing when you can in fact control that spacing. So we reduced the spacing between aircraft on approach from 3 down to the normal runway occupancy time, or 2 mile spacing, whichever was larger, and achieved another 35% increase in the traffic capacity. If all of these changes are implemented, the increase from where we are today to where we could be quite feasibly by 1980 is about 160%, and the Group 1 activity ended with a recommendation that these changes be made to the system. Now, some detailed effort was conducted to find what the right value was for the standard deviation. This graph shows the delivery accuracy to the gate. Now, the gate is a position approximately 6 miles from the touchdown point on the runway. At the bottom are the errors which we feel are reasonable for our present system and for a future automated system. We held three of these constant and varied the other, and you can see the sensitivity to delivery error of varying the various parameters. Our conclusion was that we could limit this error, that is, delivery to the gate, to about plus or minus 4 seconds. Now we have to get from the gate to touchdown, And Boeing ran some rather detailed simulations for us under various conditions. We have the manual system, the pilot flying in still air and with turbulence and wind shear. And we have various auto-throttle, autopilot combinations flying under the same conditions. You can see that the present auto-throttle is slightly better than the man. These are seconds, of course, of delivery error. We look to the Doppler ground speed system presented both to the pilot and to the autopilot. Inertial ground speed, DME ground speed. A readout of distance, which you'll see gave poorer results across the board, and precision DME ground speed that showed a slight improvement. We said in looking at these, we feel that the runout error from the gate to touchdown is about 3 seconds, and if you root sum square that with the previous figure, you come out with the 5-second number that the committee has been using. We did one further thing. This is in the category of sensitivity analysis. The missed approach rate is a critical item in establishing the buffer, which is to be added to the runway occupancy time in order to determine what your landing rate will be. One of the curves, and this perhaps is a significant one, it assumes that an aircraft, the time it crosses the threshold until it is off the runway, ties up that facility for approximately 60 seconds. With the assumption that automation then adds a 5-second error, one can derive the landing rate in arrivals per hour. Now, the bottom curve is aircraft actually landed, and the upper curve is aircraft, the difference between them, of the aircraft that went around. Well, since these have to get back into the system, you really have to subtract them from this curve. And our conclusion was that the proper number to be used for scheduling is about the 1% level, one missed approach per hour, maximum. There was no gain in trying to put them closer together. Now, in examining the various alternatives for increasing terminal capacity, it became apparent that it is far easier and quicker to expand airports than to build new ones. The electro-political problems involved in the latter one are enormous, and it takes decades, not years, to solve them. However, in many areas, both expansion and new airports are required. Our present separation standard for independent approaches is 5,000 feet between runways. This takes a lot of real estate when you talk about adding another runway. Now, the committee, therefore, determined in their study what minimum runway spacing could provide safety at least equivalent to today and what system improvements were required in order to achieve the reduced separation with equivalent safety. The improvements they recommended were the installation of a scanning beam microwave landing system, which potentially reduces the deviations on final approach by a ratio of 2-to-1 over our present system. They recommended a far more accurate data acquisition system capable of establishing aircraft position to about 100 feet at the approach gate. They indicated that a digital data link was required and that a fully automatic sequencing and spacing program was required. Now, since the data which we have available on approach deviations is somewhat limited and taken mainly at O'Hare, the group that worked on the risk calculation assumed a Gaussian distribution. And this is a very conservative assumption, since the surveillance and control process acts to truncate the tails of the distribution. Now, the control process is always acting to maximize the landing rate and to minimize the missed approaches. Now, a study of a model of the improved system forecasts the risks as a function of runway separation, and that is the tabulation on the view graph. And from this analysis, it appeared that a runway separation of 2,500 feet was safe, as safe as today. Now, it was recognized, however, that user acceptance may be highly contingent on having displays in the cockpit which show the pilot as well as the controller, and at the same time as the controller, any deviations of aircraft on adjacent runways. Now, one of the bad features of landing more aircraft is you have a lot more noise. And there was a group that worked for a considerable period of time, and they took several representative high-density airports and redesigned them to incorporate all of the improvements that I mentioned a moment ago, which are required to improve the capacity. And they also laid out the approach and departure paths to reduce the noise exposure to the population around the airport. This is one of the layouts, and it's for Kennedy Airport in New York. The present airport is in this area. These are extensions of existing runways. These are new ones out in Jamaica Bay. Through the use of the scanning beam microwave landing system and of a curved path computer in the aircraft, it is possible to define approach and departure paths where you're making one-half G turns that become straight lines 2 miles from the airport to allow the aircraft autopilot to stabilize for a normal landing. Now, these are representative of the type of work that was done by the group, and I'd like to show you the impact on the noise generated by the present configuration and also the new one. Now, we have a thing we call a noise exposure figure, and the values, 30 and 40, are related to the normal noise measurements in EPNDB, that's effective perceived noise in decibels. We've taken off the multiplying factor. The significant thing is a level of 30, one gets expressions of individual dislike all the way up to concerted group action to close the airport. And at levels of 40 and above, you get concerted, highly volatile town meeting, women pushing baby carriages down the runway, and various other expressions of distaste for the noise. So we took these two levels as kind of a way of measuring the effectiveness of the noise reduction program. The top half of the graph concerns itself with Kennedy as it is and with its expansion to 1979 for a traffic level of 790,000 operations per year. Now, with the current fleet, no modifications, no nothing, these are the square miles affected, and these are the millions of people affected. With our present noise abatement procedures, we do practically nothing to reduce the noise exposure, but everyone feels better because they know we have noise abatement procedures. If we now retrofit the four-engine jet fleet with the quiet nacelles, which have been developed, and essentially eliminate compressor noise on approach, and reduce by 10 or 15 dB the noise of the departures, we do begin to see some reduction in the exposure, both in square miles and the people who live there. Now, all the time, our traffic is expanding. The population is expanding so that we don't get as direct a reduction between the present population and the future one exposed. And here we've combined the two. There's the power cut and the retrofitted fleet, and these really do something for you. That's with Kennedy as it is. With the new runways out in Jamaica Bay, we get a much better situation if we did nothing else. And this always becomes a problem. Since the aircraft people and owners have to fix their airplane, the city of New York has to build new runways, the attitude is, well, you get some improvement for each of these things, so let the other guy do it. So we took a look. You suppose only one of the parties agreed to do something. This assumes that we have a new runway configuration. We add noise abatement procedures. This assumes that we also get the air carrier to do something, and we still have noise abatement procedures. And the figures to compare are today's population exposure and tomorrow. These are the mad people. Remember, these are the baby buggies on the runway. And while all this has been going on, this airport is saturated at about 800,000 operations. This one can handle over a million. Well, to kind of summarize Group 1's activity, the group concluded a new landing system which provides more accuracy and which provides the ability to define curved approach and departure paths for the reduction of noise exposure is required. That an improved surveillance system that possesses much improved accuracy does not suffer from the garbling and loss of data that our present beacon system provides us with at no charge. A higher data rate, we need data about once per second on final approach. That all of these things, plus automatic communications, are required in the future data acquisition system. The automation of the ATC function is required. This includes sequencing and spacing, collision avoidance, and the data link function. Additional runways, and these are dual-lane runways on existing airports. It is feasible to safely reduce separation standards when you have done all of these other things, and to use 2-mile longitudinal separation on final approach. A considerable amount of work was done on the effects of wake turbulence and procedures to minimize their effects. In addition, they defined a method of dissipating wakes on the surface of the airport, which becomes the most serious place. And, of course, they recommended all of the things involved in reducing noise: curved approaches, quiet engines, and power reduction procedures. Now, we are very concerned about the cost of the air traffic control system, and this chart shows you what the increased forecast increase in people is between now and 1979. And this increase in people at the present rate of inflation means our ATC system will cost an additional $1 billion a year in that time period. Now, by adding sectors and by putting in the present level of automation, we will saturate in 1979. To handle additional traffic, we have to provide automation of all of the other functions we have mentioned, and it is then possible to postpone saturation until the year 1995 in our high-density area. Now, we did a little study in the New York Center. We took data from 24 sectors over a considerable period of time to find out what they did, what percentage of their time was spent in doing each function, and then forecast what improvement we might get in automating the functions. And you can see that merely bringing in altitude data, which is one of the functions of our present program, doesn't do very much. That you really have to automate the decision-making functions, the conflict resolution, the sequencing and spacing, and provide a data link if you are to achieve a 2 to 3 times increase in the number of aircraft that each controller can handle. And the committee recommended automation on this basis. Group 3 was concerned with safety. It's a touchy subject, but I would like to summarize it briefly for you and what the forecast is if we continue in the direction we have been going. First slide is kind of a measure of the effectiveness of positive control. Now, the group which developed the model defined F, a traffic factor, as being proportional to the number of hours, the product of the number of hours of the groups involved. This is done on an annual basis, times the average velocity between the aircraft involved. The second column is the same thing expressed in percent. And the third column is a summary of the inferred near-mid-air collision. And a near-mid-air collision is defined as any condition where two aircraft pass within 250 feet of each other. They see each other at that distance, and where it is ineffective to attempt any dodging maneuvers. And it is considered that the people missed purely by chance. They could just as well have hit. And the model, which was developed by the group, tried to find the factor that this column should be multiplied by to arrive at the forecast accident rate. There's some interesting things on this chart. Air carrier versus air carrier is the top, and military versus military near-miss incidents are at the bottom. The air carrier are primarily IFR, under control of the system, not completely, but primarily, whereas the military are not. These are predominantly VFR. Now, you find in the case of the military that the near-miss percentage is quite close to the traffic factor, and this seems a normal situation. Whereas the air carrier incidents are very much reduced, which is some measure, at least, of how well the air traffic control system is performing in its present method of operation. Now, the air carrier and general aviation exposure is about as you would expect it. The air carrier and military is lower because they tend to use different airports, and hence the terminal exposure is reduced. General aviation exposure, however, is above the factor, and this is normal since they tend to congregate at the same airport, and fully half of their operations are local operations in and around the traffic pattern of that airport. They are in close proximity to each other, and the near-miss figures tend to indicate they come close together rather frequently. General aviation and military, again, they operate normally from different fields, and so the near-miss probability is somewhat lower than the traffic factor would tend to indicate. Now, I won't attempt to explain the committee's work in any depth, but they spent a considerable amount of time in developing these figures. They took one group, the air carrier, and versus the general aviation type of near miss. Traffic factor again is shown for 4 years. The inferred near misses for 1 year. This is the year that the data was analyzed for in some depth. The method of doing it, they took the number of near miss situations that were reported by the air carriers. There were 103. The number reported by general aviation, 44. And the number reported by both, 14. And from that developed the probability that each class, that is how many of the actual situations would be reported, and from that they inferred that there were in fact somewhere in the order of 485 near misses in this category. And this of course is a very serious one because it's between aircraft which can carry a lot of equipment and aircraft that are going to carry practically nothing unless we get tough with them and insist on it. And it's representative of the type of accident that we had at Indianapolis. In the right-hand column are the collisions between air carrier and general aviation for the 4 years. Unfortunately, the master didn't print on the graph, so you will have to imagine that there are some 21 dots surrounding that line. Now, what the group did was to plot the traffic factor for the 21 top terminals in this country. And this is the terminal factor. The F130 means these are incidents between aircraft within 30 miles and less than 5,000 feet above the ground. This is the terminal area problem. Plotted traffic factor against inferred near-miss collision to get a correlation factor, which they used in the development of the figures on the previous view graph. The significant thing is that the model was to some extent verified by this plot in that all of the figures or all of the dots that you can't see and have to trust me are actually very close to that line. Now the factor that you multiply near-miss situations by to get collisions was developed in several ways. The summary of the various ways is shown at the top. It's somewhere between 0.5% and 1% of the forecast near-miss situations will result in collisions. One way of looking at it, the geometric argument takes the ratio of the aircraft cross-section and compares it to a 250-foot near-miss. That is a circle of 250 feet radius. If you do it that way, you find the factor is 1%. If you merely divide the statistics out, you find it's 0.5%. So somewhere in that ballpark is the right number. This would say that there should have been in 68 2.5 accidents. There were 3. Apparently they rounded upward. But the significant thing is that the accident rate increases directly with the factor, and the factor is the square of the traffic. Therefore, we can expect, if nothing further is done, 10 collisions a year in this category by 1980. The committee concluded that this was unacceptable and recommended that the ground system do something about it, the automation system. Their recommendation was for the establishment of intermittent positive control for all aircraft flying in control airspace in the vicinity of medium and high-density airports. Now, in this view graph, we have a circle which represents the non-transgression zone. And we have kind of a half a mushroom in front, which represents the positions that aircraft could be located in if he were to do anything he liked in the next period of time. Now the computer will look at the gray areas every data cycle, and wherever it finds an overlap, will then examine to see whether or not a command should be given to the aircraft. The pilot receives via data link one of two types of command. One that says, don't turn right, don't climb, don't descend, or don't do something, or you'll run into somebody. His mushroom has overlapped somebody else's, but if he continues on his present heading, he will not penetrate the 2,000-foot circle around the other aircraft. Or it tells him, the outer indicators, do turn right, do climb, do descend, or you'll run into somebody. Now, to see whether this was a feasible thing to do, we took the Los Angeles Basin in 1990. You see the statistics at the top, about 145 IFR, about 1,220 VFR aircraft in the lower airspace where the problem exists. If you take a warning time of 20 seconds, which we feel is compatible with the speeds of the VFR aircraft, and you take a standard turn rate for generating your mushroom, you'll find that you will get 1.41 approximately don't turn commands per hour, and about 0.01 do turn commands for encounters between IFR and VFR. This is the air carrier general aviation condition from our previous slide. With regard to VFR-VFR encounters, which are much higher, he will get the difference between these two numbers in don't commands and this many do commands per hour, and so on. If you increase the warning time, you will increase the number of false alarms which you will give him. And that is why one tends toward the 20 seconds as the ideal warning time for light aircraft. Now, as you expand the traffic to 2 and 4 times these values, the number of times that you interfere with what the pilot would like to do will increase. And at some point in time, one can no longer allow the free transit with the occasional interference with his normal desires. And it is necessary to establish procedural VFR highways in such high-density areas and to use the same indicator, same type of control, to keep the aircraft on these highways. Now, this shows you briefly the number and types of facilities that we foresee for the 1980 to 1990 time period. We'll have the continue to have traffic control centers in a distributed manner as we have today. They include the oceanic traffic control sectors, which in many cases represent 4 or 5 times the area of the domestic centers. There will probably be some new control sectors for military high-speed aircraft and also SSTs if and when. Continue to have flight service stations and a variety of terminal facilities, each with their own unique demand. In addition, we will continue to have the airport reservation service that we initiated this year, where you get your reservations in and out of the major airports. These are the automation functions that the committee has recommended, and here's how the system might appear and operate come 1980-1990. The pilot, somewhat similar to today, must get a reservation at the airport that he intends to depart from or arrive at or both. He next files his flight plan, perhaps in a simpler manner than today, with the en route traffic control center. Once he is off, he will receive his clearance prior to takeoff. Here is really the flow regulation system. National Flow Control provides the reservations in areas where capacity is not up to demand. It supplies arrival and departure lists to the terminal scheduling functions at each of the major terminals where the capacity is not sufficient. The terminal feeds back the rates actually being made good to provide the feedback loop in controlling the generation rate of aircraft to prevent large delays en route. There's also a smaller route with the center. If a major rate reduction occurs, we would like to start en route speed control immediately to limit the arrival rate into the high-density terminal airspace. Once the aircraft is aloft, the data received via data link will be used to establish his position and also to get from him certain messages. These are used to drive the tracking function. The track positions are compared periodically with the filed flight plan and used to update the flight data on the flight, which is displayed to the controller in the form of sequences of traffic for the various areas. In addition, the flight plan position is compared with the track position to detect any lateral deviations, which are used to generate through the command control process commands to the pilot to put him back either on final approach or back on the route if he has deviated laterally. As the aircraft comes into the high-density area, the command control function will be sending desired positions to be compared with actual positions longitudinally or along track. Deviations then are used to generate the commands to the aircraft to slow him down and deliver him to the approach gate on time. Each of the proposed command control actions is checked to be sure it does not generate a conflict before being issued. In addition, flight data on all flights in the system will be periodically checked by this function, and any potential collision stored for future action. At the start of the group's activity, we didn't have a very good forecast, so we made up our own. And this is kind of a summary of the model used to estimate the size of the computer required for 1995. As it turns out, this is about 2 times the traffic which the forecast group finally came up with for that time period, so that our estimates, if they're 2 to 1 off, we're still right. Now, the Los Angeles Basin, 60 by 120 miles, we'll have about 1,385 aircraft in 1980, tripling by 1995. And you see the number of airports, the number of data acquisition devices, which the computer must do business with. Now, we were forced to get down in considerable more detail in saying how many aircraft, where are they, how many are on approach, how many are controlled, how many are uncontrolled, how many are in positive controlled airspace, in mixed VFR, IFR, and so on. So this is an indication of the level of complexity the group was forced to go to in their forecasting activity. Well, the result of doing all this was a set of numbers arrived at after much discussion and a lot of work and some simulation activity. This is based on 10 times today's traffic, or twice 1995. You can see that the ground collision avoidance function takes up about 10% or so of the computer's activity. The data acquisition number is quite high because it includes the correlation between the cooperative data link system, as the comparison of data derived from the cooperative system, with the primary radar data to detect aircraft whose equipment has failed or who are cheating, and so on. This represents an enormous workload and led the committee to the conclusion that they should stress duplexing equipment in all commercial aircraft to achieve a high reliability in all of the equipment, and to ultimately discontinue the use of primary radar as a part of the air traffic control system. The command and control function was not a big one. Now, some of the additional en route functions, we lumped all of the functions in our present system into that category. Flight data processing, distribution, updating, comparison with tracking, display refreshing, and so on, are all in the next larger number. Central flow control, and also its ramifications on terminal scheduling and on the en route flow control process, was a rather negligible amount of computation. Now, the total from the previous slide is at the top of this one. That represents the number of instructions per second which one serial processor would have to perform if you wrote a perfect program, a highly efficient program, and a lot of other ifs. So we were faced with the problem of degrading this to real life, and this is where we got some use out of Dr. Glazer, our advisor on this group, and we used his factors. The instruction mix degradation really means nothing. It says if your average instruction execution time is, for example, 5 microseconds, and your add time is 2.5 microseconds, you have a ratio of 2. It's something the computer manufacturers use in telling you how fast the machine is. So that converts it to an equivalent add instruction. The multiprocessing executive overhead and the error analysis programs and all the other goodies, reconfiguration programs, double it again. And the high-level language degradation, everyone knows compilers are somewhat less than perfect, adds some further degradation. Well, the important thing is that we're talking about a 40 million instruction per second machine as being the price of admission to the traffic control system. That is, we must have that capability by 1995. In examining the technology, the computer sizing group concluded that there would be machines available by 1975, which in a multiprocessing configuration could meet these speed requirements. They divided their program into 3 areas. 1, increasing airport capacity. First item was for the type of studies we talked about earlier. Type of runway configurations, taxiway configurations, gate configurations, subways to downtown, all of the things involved in developing an airport plan. Some of them are very forward-looking. People would be loaded into buses in midtown Manhattan and would be unloaded directly on the airplane. Freight would be palletized downtown and shipped by the subway to make it a profitable arrangement. And this will minimize, if you will, the number of buildings and people and so on competing for space on the surface of the airport. As the study pointed out fairly clearly, when you put runways 2,500 feet apart, certain things such as huge sprawling freight terminals, large parking lots, and so on, no longer have room on the airport. It's this sort of thing which is included in the first. The development of the scanning beam microwave ILS system, and also the development of the curved path computer to go with it. Very important, the flight testing of the total recommended automation for the terminal area to prove that one can, in fact, operate safely with this type of system. Wake turbulent studies, a traffic control system for the surface of the airport, including zero-zero guidance. So it's the detection, the guidance, and the control of aircraft when neither party can see the other or the ground. Increasing airspace capacity, perhaps another name for automation. The first one is really to study in depth the integration of the data link function into the air traffic control system to determine what functions would be done by the processor at the site, what done by the processor at the various control facilities. Second one is to develop the modernization and improvement of the ATC radar beacon system and integrate into it the data link function. The NAS and ARTS automation extensions are to add the functions that we discussed briefly a minute ago. Technique developments include answering some of the basic questions which were raised during the course of the study. One of them was the effect of multipath on deteriorating signals exchanged in an omnidirectional system, such as the time frequency and the collision avoidance system. The committee was fairly strong in saying that they did not feel that we could solve those problems and recommended no further development in the time frequency area. Also included under technique developments is the construction, design and construction of the first Atlantic Pacific Oceanic satellite control system. Looking toward the future, the committee wanted studies conducted to determine what is the next step, really. Realizing that the recommended automation, adding sectors and so on, would only carry you to 1995, some planning should be started now as to the more fully automatic system starting in the year 1990. They also recommended, as we noted earlier, continued studies to develop the satellite technology necessary to support a large airborne fleet. Thank you.